Please.
Thursday, January 21st, and I am, William M. Jones, am interviewing Reverend Philip Antela as part of the Oral History Project. I trust I can call you Phil. It's,
yes.
It's just going to be burdensome otherwise.
I was afraid you were going to ask me my whole moniker.
We may get to that. Who knows? I think it would be useful just to get some biographical details first. You were born where and went to school where and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I was born in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, to immigrant parents Samuel and Matilda Antela. I'm the 12th of 13 children. It may be that it would have stopped at 10, at 11, but our house burned and the two youngest died in that fire, and so my brother and I, my brother David, younger than I, were replacements. I was born on the 6th of November 1920. That had happened in Monessen, Pennsylvania. And it was a year, 2 years after that fire, that there was just too much associated with sadness that they moved to Newcastle, Pennsylvania, which is about 80 miles, would be 80 miles northwest of Pittsburgh. But in any event, mother was very graphic about my birth. You know, we lived at the first stop on Court Street in Newcastle, 823 Court Street, and the mailman, the first stop for the mailman on a rural route. So we were sort of rural, but we were at the edge of the city. And it was a little bit of a walk up the hill and across the street to the mailbox, a dirt road. And it was at that mailbox that she knew, she wondered if she would make it back to the house. And so I guess...
You came in a hurry. Huh?
That well, and it was a mailman that was born. Yeah. Then I went to school in Newcastle and graduated from Newcastle High School in 1942. And I went to Suomi College in Hancock, Michigan. That we were members of the Suomi Synod, the Finnish Evangelical Lutheran Church. Again, as with many of the Scandinavians, and although I understand there's some question about whether Finns are Scandinavians or not, but...
With that terrible language of theirs.
It is.
Nobody
it is.
Can figure out.
Exactly. not even the Finn. It is a difficult language. And you know that, and I had to digress, because it has been reported, and again and again and again, that it has some sort of an Estonian connection. It has not. It has not. Hungarian, I'm sorry. It has more Estonian connection than Hungarian, but it takes a lot of the stretching of the imagination to see any kind of linguistic relationship between Hungarian and Finnish.
Did you know Finnish?
Oh, that's my first language.
That's
I didn't,
first language. Mm-hmm.
When I went to school, as I said, I was born in 1922, and so 1928, when I went to school, I did not let my mother lead me to school because my mother could not speak English, and I was embarrassed being a foreigner. You know, the poetry that I was raised on was hunky dago, Finn and Wop, eat ice cream with worms on top in our neighborhood. And I wanted to go, and my baptismal name is Armus, Raphael, Philip. And I didn't want any of those monikers given to me. Imagine, I was 6 years old, and so I went and gave my name as Philip. I went without her. I ran to school and went without her. And in any event, when we spoke Finnish at home, and I didn't know, Mary Had a Little Lamb or Jack and Jill Went Up the Hill or How to Count to 100 or the ABCs. I knew all that kind of stuff, corresponding kind of stuff in Finnish, but my English was street, a foreign neighborhood kind of English. I don't got no kind of stuff, you know. And then school, grade school, was difficult because you just didn't have those fundamental building blocks upon which they could build. They had to start from scratch, and they didn't do it. I mean, the foreigners were looked upon as something that they didn't particularly care to have in their classes. And we were Italians and Polish, and primarily Italian, Polish, and very few Finns in that particular part of town. Nevertheless, I went through the system. And then in about the 10th grade, things started to gel. I didn't like school. because I was always behind, because I started behind. And then in high school, it started to gel, and there was a history teacher, I'll never forget her, Miss Calvin. And she took an interest in me. The first time that I knew that any teacher ever took an interest in me. And she got me interested in history. And my grades started to improve because somebody approved of me, you know. And my grades picked up, and it was then that I started thinking of college. I never dreamed of going to college. I was going to go work in the coal mines with my parents, you know, and brothers and my dad. But in any event, that senior year, I graduated in 42. And after I graduated, then it was in 40. I graduated in 1942, and a guy came from Suomi College, a kind of a recruiter, and he came to talk to me, and if I had had any kind of an interest, it would have been law. That's what it was. My brother, who is a retired professor at the University of Puerto Rico right now, PhD, he was trying to nurture me. He began to see some things, and he was an Ohio State graduate. And he got his PhD out of Columbia. But in any event, he was nurturing me, and he was intent on my being a lawyer, and I was interested in that sort of a thing, because we lived near the courthouse, and there were some great battles fought in that court. Glenn Schroeder, Irene Daigle, you never heard of them, but they murdered some policemen in Pennsylvania, and that trial was held there, and they had a little boy, and I saw that, and he was, both of them were electrocuted, and that little boy was left to go live with relatives. Well, that was quite, it interested me. I got interested in law at that same time, and my brother was encouraging it. But then this guy came, this recruiter came from Suomi College. He was a nice fellow. And I had never dreamed that I would be going to college reasonably soon, because, again, I didn't show any ability in that way until the 10th grade. And so anyhow, he talked to me about Suomi College, and that began to look as though that would be something that would be within reason financially. And I was working, I graduated in January. They had midterm graduations, and so I was working on the railroad, and just a Gandhi dancer, or the car shop repairing the cars as they came in before they would go out with new loads. Mm-hmm. And so anyhow, he interested me in Suomi College, and that made some sense, because I also had that ethnic kind of thing, that my people were Finns, and I was going to be there with them. I'd be sheltered from this other kind of stuff. So I went up there, and at the same time, I was thinking in terms of law. But I had a kind of experience that I don't really care to go into in terms of detail, but I started to think about the ministry. Mm-hmm. So I went up to Suomi College then in the, I graduated in January of 42, so it was in 43, in the fall. And about that time, we were all getting our registration classifications back. And because I was thinking of law or the theology, they classified me as what they called a 4D, or divinity student. Mm-hmm. And when I got up there, because I had been torn between law and the church, I wondered if I were a draft dodger, and that bothered me. Mm-hmm. And I must confess, I wondered about a lot of the students that seminaries were getting filled up. The pre-theological school was being deferred. And so when I went home for Christmas vacation, I just started there in September, I went home for Christmas vacation, I changed my classification. And they classified me from a 4D to 1A. And I went back then after Christmas vacation, and in January I got the letter, your friends and neighbors, you know. Mm-hmm. And so then I went into the service, and I was in the service for essentially 3 years, ending up as a staff sergeant, having flown 25 combat missions as a tail gunner in the South Pacific. Mm-hmm. And all of that while, The ministry was still working at me. Now, this sounds crazy, but if you take, you know, the story of Jonah and the whale, well, if I were to tell my story, I guess it would be Philip and the bird, because I was in the rear end of a bird,
sure,
not in the stomach of a whale, you know.
Yep.
And I was a tail gunner, and appropriately enough, you had to fly on your knees. You had sort of a bicycle seat that you sort of sat on, but you were also on your knees so that you could fire those two 50 caliber machine guns, each of which handled 1,100 rounds of ammunition, so you had 2,200 rounds that you fired. But in any event, so the war ended, and I came back home, and now I had money. The whole thing was before
GI Bill.
That's
course.
Right, sure. And I didn't have to worry about that, and I had saved money in the service as well. So then I went to Wittenberg University in Springfield, Ohio, and I majored in political science and history because I had a fine advisor, even though I was going to go into the seminary. He said, don't burden yourself with Bible and theology and Greek and Latin. He said, take all of the things that will be helpful to you. And he suggested history and political science so that you have some awareness of what's going on in the real world.
Sure.
And so I did. And I belong to a historical honorary, and I belong to a political science honorary. And then I graduated from Wittenberg in 1944 in the summer. And I went right up to the seminary that fall. I went summers and winters to school, and that's a mistake. I would never advise it. You get a kind of a burnout.
Yeah.
And then I went into the seminary, and I was ordained by the... I graduated there at Wittenberg University then in 1946, and then I went right up into the seminary and graduated from the seminary in 1951. And I was ordained at First English Lutheran Church in Toledo, Ohio in May of 1951. And my Finnish kind of roots had been really uprooted when I went into the service.
Mm-hmm.
And I caught up on a lot of things. I read a lot in the service, and I caught up. And I had no problems in college. I had some problems at Suomi College. Because I wasn't that interested. But I did well in college, and I did well in the seminary.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that I was attracted to books, and I have ever since had my nose in a book's reading something or other, even if it's things on breakfast boxes of cereal. the same brother Earl, who in Puerto Rico retired, he must have taught me to read. I don't know that he taught me to read. He would read stuff at the breakfast table, and these milk cans that you had, Pet and Wilson and Carnation milk can, and on the back of each was written a kind of a description of its content. And on the back it says, by adding one part of water to one part of the content of this can, the resulting milk product will be obtained, which will not be below the legal standard for whole milk. And so I had read that and heard him read it so often that I memorized it.
Sure.
And I recall one time with the kids on the street, when the old-fashioned kind of grocery stores, neighborhood grocery store, and the grocer put displays up in the window and changed those displays each week of what he had on sale. Well, I'll never forget the Wilson and Carnation milk cans, because they were displayed, and we were testing how good our eyesight was. You know, I must have been a third, fourth grader at the time. And we would get back across, and we would read what we could on these displays in these store windows. And I went completely across the street and read that typewritten size print. And I strained, but I had memorized it.
Sure.
And it was identical on every can of milk, you know, that whether it was Carnation or whatnot, they had that same print. Well, anyhow, after I finished Hama School of Theology down in Springfield, which is now part of Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, I did not go back to serve the Suomi Synod. Mm-hmm. I went to the United Lutheran Church, and my first parish was in Niles, Ohio. And I won't go into any of that. It was a strange kind of a thing. I immediately ran into ethical problems of the ministry because of my predecessor. But in any event, I was there for 4 years. And then the Finnish church, the largest Finnish church in the United States outside of Finland, the largest Finnish language church in the world outside of Finland was in Zion Lutheran Church, Fairport Harbor, Ohio at the time, and it had maybe 18 to 2,000 members. Yeah. And the pastor there was elected the president of the Suomi Synod, of which it was a member. And it was about 50 miles from Niles, Ohio, and I knew him to a degree. But anyhow, he suggested that the congregation call me. Well, that came out of the clear blue sky. And they called me sight unseen. But they knew my family, and because my Newcastle, Pennsylvania wasn't 80 miles away from there. They knew my family because my family was connected to the church in many ways. Well, anyhow, I responded that I had been away from the Finnish language so long that I felt that I wouldn't be able to handle the Finnish language aspect. Well, then they sent a committee down, and the committee was made up of bilingual people and a lot of unilingual, just Finnish-speaking people. And they said that you speak the same Finnish we do. That was the Finnish spoken in Finland in the 1800s. And it hadn't changed significantly because they had to take care of their own printing and everything else, and it stayed relatively the same. It's not like, I guess it would be compared to Shakespearean English to our English.
Sure.
Something of that. In any event, I went then to that Finnish church, and I continued my contact in Ohio with Wittenberg University and Ham School of Theology and continuing education kind of courses. But then I worked through the merger. I became the secretary of the Suomi Synod, and the Suomi Synod, along with the Augustana Lutheran Church, along with the Danish Lutheran Church and the United Lutheran Church in America. And I served United Lutheran Church, and now I was in the Suomi Synod, and I was its secretary. So I became a signatory to one of the eight signatories of the what became then the Lutheran Church in America, the merger of those, the Danes, the Finns, the Swedes, and the Germans. And Dr. Fry became the first president. And then in the Lutheran Church in America, in 1963, I left the Finnish parish that I was serving, and I served for a year after the merger occurred. I went to Olivet Lutheran Church in Sylvania, Ohio, and I served there from 63 to 69. And I was a member of the executive board of the Ohio Synod, and I've been a member of somebody's executive board practically ever since I was ordained. And then in 69, I came here to Bethesda Lutheran Church, Moorhead, Minnesota, and last November, 1987, November the 6th, my 65th birthday, I retired from that parish.
Mm-hmm.
I probably gave you more than you wanted.
No, that's very good. Now, Bethesda, was it in its present building at that when you arrived?
No, it was the old building.
The old building downtown.
I think you had something to do with it. You directed a choir.
I directed the choir there back in the early 40s, right.
Yeah. I arrived there in 1969, and then it was in that we built the dedicated new building in, was it 72? 72.
Mm-hmm. So you were involved then in that whole process of identifying the site.
That's one of the reasons they called me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there was some motive. They had decided that they, one of two things, they'd either renovate or they would rebuild. At the time, the Board of American Missions had some property in South Moorhead. And the idea was that we needed another church, and because there was the hope that the Lutheran churches would merge, it was sort of, it was a critical point. Maybe what we should do was relocate that church, because if merger ever occurred, we'd be next door to Trinity, and you'd have two churches.
Took a while, but
happened. But it was either we stay where we were, and they would still build a mission out in South Moorhead, or turn it over to the Missouri Synod for a mission. And so Bethesda then decided that it would go south. And in retrospect now, it was a very wise decision because that merger has occurred.
Right.
And they needed a church out there, and that's the ELCA church out there now.
Now, Bethesda was originally Swedish.
Yeah.
Has it retained that kind of identity?
No. it has a kind of heritage that's rooted in things Swedish, and the Swedish Cultural Heritage Society goes out there for, it was its headquarters for its Christmas Santa Lucia kind of thing. Now they're taking it to various churches, but there isn't anything particularly Swedish any more than the churches in the community are particularly Norwegian. They mm-hmm. may have a Norwegian heritage, but the language obviously plays no role.
And I suppose it'd be hard to guess even what proportion of the membership is Swedish.
Well, I suppose if you rated them, Swedish heritage and Norwegian heritage would be almost neck and neck. It's interesting that I asked Dean Bagney, who was a member of our church, had joined, and he was of Norwegian background and from Trinity, and he was the chairman of the stewardship committee. And at one congregational meeting, I asked him to make some comments. He got up, he said, "I feel out of place in a Swedish setting here as a Norwegian to talk about stewardship." And I stopped him. I said, "Well, let's just see." I said, "Now, how many here are Swedish?" And a good number raised their hand. And I said, "How many here are Norwegian?" And an equal number raised their hand. And I said, "Well, you see that it's neither Norwegian nor Swedish." And then the rest of them were other nationalities.
Sure.
So,
sure. Now, as you think through your career in the ministry, and of course we're more interested in that part of the career that's located in this area, but I don't think we need to confine ourselves to that. Let's touch on some topics, and you give your assessment of the changes that you've seen occur during the years. The worship experience, for example, has that undergone a change, and in what way?
Well, it's all of the churches of the ELCA, not all of them, but most of them, come out of a liturgical heritage that's similar. The German Lutheran Church and its liturgy that traces back to Martin Luther. Then the baptizing of all of Scandinavia into the Lutheran faith, of sending scholars down to Germany to study and then to bring it back. So therefore it was brought to Sweden, and there was a high church liturgy. And so that's common to the heritage of all of the churches, essentially, to constitute what is now the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America.
Relatively consistently through the years.
Yeah, mm-hmm. there. I have gone through the United Lutheran Church hymnal. I've gone through the Augustana hymnal, and I've gone through the red hymnal, and I've gone through the green hymnal. And there are four hymnals mm-hmm. in my time, and there are some little refinements in the liturgy, but
the overall structure.
That's right. The difference would be a lay involvement. Lay ministry. There was a time when only the clergyman could ever go into that altar area or to the pulpit particularly. Mm-hmm. And in fact, oftentimes the churches have lecterns from which the scriptures are read, and they reserve that pulpit for the preaching. That was a kind of a compromise to utilize laymen who could go over there, but they couldn't go over here, yeah. Nor could they go into the chancel area. But that's all different now. Laymen participate, and
so, therefore, to some degree, the status of the minister is somewhat changed. In other words, the priesthood, with priest being someone set apart as the sole
custodian of the sacrament.
Yes, and all that. That's not quite so rigid.
Yes, I think that the distinction is very, very clear, and the demarcation in terms of responsibility are as clear as they ever were. Laymen have always been able, for instance, to baptize mm-hmm. In an emergency situation, but for the sake of good order, where you have a clergy person, then the clergyman should do that.
Mm-hmm.
We have the distribution of the sacrament by the laity, but the consecration of the elements is done by the clergy. There is the office of the ministry. Now, In the Lutheran Church, the office of the ministry is precisely that. It's an office. It's not an order of creation. Mm-hmm. It's an office, and mm-hmm. we fill an office.
Mm-hmm.
And the responsibilities of the office, like the office of the mayor, are very clear. And
that's been fairly consistent.
Yes,
through the
that that still is consistent.
Right.
And the utilization of the laypersons is nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
There were historic things that happened, and I know that Scandinavia would like very much to have a greater kind of a lay participation than what they have.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty much the ministers talking to each other.
But here, the immigrants had to do much for themselves while the pastor was not around, and then they have these circuit preachers that came around for a long while. And then they had these homemade guys that decided that they were the preachers, you know, and mm-hmm. that caused problems and caused mm-hmm. a split and a division within the Lutheran Church and many, many divisions.
How about the role of the church as it applies to education? Has that changed?
No, mm-hmm. it has not changed. The church has always underscored the need for educated laity and clergy. The first thing that those immigrants would do would be try to set up a university or school or seminary. And in many ways, particularly in the Finnish church, and in most all of them, they viewed the immigration, the departure of persons from their country, as, well, that Lazarus writes on her that little thing on a Statue of Liberty, Emma Lazarus wrote, "Give me your outcasts and
yes.
tramps and all of that."
Yes.
Yeah, that's what they believed us to be.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't send the clergy with those early immigrants. There were singular persons, but it was not a practice of the church mm-hmm. to attend to these people who chose to leave the fatherland.
So therefore, you had to create this professional class.
Exactly, and mm-hmm. that was true in all of the churches. Perhaps the best in following its people was a Swedish church, but therefore also, I guess, Norwegian, because that was they were interrelated as a nation there for a good while. In fact, here in this country, you know, they had their Augustana College, and then when Norway got its independence of Sweden, they broke, separated into the Norwegian, it was all Augustana once. We had mm-hmm. Augustana College, and so we have theirs, and they created theirs. So you have two Augustana colleges as mm-hmm. a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
And there, but the frontier people, the immigrant people, they shifted for themselves, and their emphasis was on an educated, trained ministry.
Now, education within the church, confirmation, for example, which is a major educational effort, has that changed much during the course of the years?
Well, if I go to my experience, there was a church school experience that you just simply attended, and then when you got to the age of 15 or 16, then you went to the pastor's class. And this was generally the pattern that was followed by the Norwegians and the Swedes and the Finns and the Danes. And then you were confirmed, and then you could go from the Finnish Sunday school to the English Sunday school adult class. You know?
Mm-hmm.
You graduated into English. But the patterns are still the same. There are congregations where pastors entrust the instruction to the lay people, but that's the general pattern is that pastor does deal with confirmation years.
And you had pastor's class in your charges.
That's right. Yeah, they run concurrently with the school term.
Right. How about the content? Does the theology go through some changes during the course of that time?
I believe that there is probably less of a comprehension of the scripture and a less thoroughgoing understanding of the doctrine It used to be that, you know, you would get a Bible history and you would read it, that Bible history from the front to the back, and then the next year in grade two you'd use the same book and go through it again in grade three, and all the way through that Bible history, you know. And part of the problem in all of that was that you could get through Old Testament, you get through New Testament, but you couldn't get through the epistle life. You couldn't get through the life of St. Paul. I think that most of those of my age, other than if they went to seminary, know very little about St. Paul. Because you started at the front of the book every year, and you went through as far as you could go, and you could end of the year. That's where, and the same goes about baptism. And baptism and the Lord's Supper was the same thing.
Yeah,
that came at the end of the catechism, and you did that hurriedly. In the new curriculum, those are attended to earlier. Mm-hmm. In fact, you prepare for First Communion now in the sixth grade. Now that has changed. Where it used to be that it was with confirmation, then you were admitted to the Lord's table. But all of that has changed because, there's an argument within the church now of whether or not infants shouldn't be permitted to the sacrament of the Lord's table. Why should infants be forbidden?
Mm-hmm.
That it depends on grace, not on knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I opposed this early confirmation, sixth grade. I didn't think they were bright enough.
Yeah.
And I was totally wrong. I wrote a letter protesting to the commission.
Is that right?
And there, it is an ideal time in the sixth grade level to prepare them for First Communion. There is a mystery to them, and they come with a receptive attitude. This is indeed the real presence here.
Mm-hmm.
They're not trying to analyze it all, as a high school kid.
Yeah.
And then when they come to it in the confirmation years, they've already been exposed to it, and they get a new introduction to it.
Mm-hmm.
Built upon an experience. I think it's great. So, and that is one positive kind of thing that happened, early communion.
Yeah.
But they went through a stage of making the scripture relevant. And so, rather than to know anything about creation, to know Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and right down through the line, including the names of the Bible books, I think something's been lost there.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's got to be a relevant kind of thing.
And there's no value in biblical literacy per se.
Yeah, but then again, the value is that you're learning things logically rather than in a context of your theology and the scriptures of your faith.
Mm-hmm.
Be good to your neighbor kind of thing, you know. It is not viewed as a kind of a God intention. It's good
practical
practice. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That introduces another aspect of church life, concern for the church's responsibility towards social problems. Has that changed?
You know, the question seems to predicate that there was a kind of a living in a closet kind of thing versus openness. I don't relate to that, because I believe that the immigrants in this country were facing real problems. They were wrestling with real life situations. They weren't monkeying around with theology that much, but in the context of their real life experience, the church was a strengthening factor. The church took sides up in the Iron Range, for instance, in the year of the Wobblies back prior to World War I, when the immigrant Finn were trying to organize the
mm-hmm.
mines up there.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had also, in the Finns, you had a strong red strain. They call them communist. That has a history with Russia.
Sure.
And back in those days, so many of when they had the Finnish, the war in Finland between the Reds and the Whites, and the whites won, they kicked the reds out, and many of them came over here, and many went to Russia. And here, you found the Finnish community of immigrants of these two schools, the people who went to the hall and the people that went to the church. But and neither would have anything to do with the other, except there was alcohol problems, and there was a temperance society, and that played a role in bringing these two groups that would have nothing to do with each other together. It was a vital, vital part of the development of the Finnish people in this country. Well, I think that social problems and the realities of living and all of these things were a mix of the religion of the people. And they found strength in knowing that in spite of the realities of living, that they were still people of God struggling to make their own kind of witness in this world, but it was real. It wasn't a pious, holy kind of right in the corner where you are. Yeah. It was simply living life and being fed.
Now, Bethesda, rightly or wrongly, and obviously you can need to comment on that, the public perception of Bethesda is that it is the more liberal of the congregations, Lutheran congregations in this community. I don't know, I guess you could probably say liberal. When the word liberal emerges, then what do you mean? Yeah. Possibly theologically, possibly concern for various social problems. I would guess those are the two things. Is there any justification for that perception?
Well, again, I indicated earlier that in the immigrant church, the Swedes, more than any of the other Scandinavian countries, sent clergy with the people, right smack dab back into the Swedes along the Delaware, back in pre-colonial America, or colonial America. They did conscientiously seek to provide ministry, and they did it. Now, if you follow the life of Archbishop Söderblom of the Church of Sweden, he was a kingpin in ecumenicity. He was a kingpin in the social concerns in which the faith should play a vital role. And so the Swedes have always been trailblazers in liturgy and in the forms of worship and in true human concern within the context of the faith. And I don't think that you can separate the religious life of the people from their daily life. It was intermeshed. It was intermeshed. You did have branching off of people who wanted to be more fundamental. You had all kind of sects. S-E-C-T-S.
Yes. All denominations have had that kind of divergence.
But I think of all the churches, particularly the Swedish church, that they were wholesome. They were wholesome in their approach to life and theology.
I think it would be interesting if you would go back in your own memory and maybe cite one or two things in which you took a great deal of satisfaction as far as your professional accomplishments, or maybe your work within the community or something like that. And if you want to, one or two things which occasion an awful lot of frustration. Might as well have balance here.
Oh, I have been, well, I guess, blessed in that I have been involved in the machinery of the church since my ordination. It's interesting that back in Ohio, I belonged to the Eastern Conference of the Synod of Ohio, and Dr. Frank and Clark Fry, who had been a pastor in Akron, Ohio, belonged to that same conference, and he had been elected several years before to the presidency of the then United Lutheran Church in America. Well, he's quite a figure in world Lutheranism, and Well, as in any event, I got stuck with a secretary's job in that Eastern Conference, and that was always a newly ordained person got that job. But he, in that time, in that day, in the United Lutheran Church, you belonged to a synod. You did not belong to a national church. You belonged to a synod. And the synod then was represented on the national level. Well, whenever the conference, anything met in the synod, Fry would come back, even to the conference meeting of the Eastern Conference Synod of Ohio, which had, which was nothing, really. Because you could see they gave a young squirt the job of being the secretary. Well, here I was sitting at the desk, and this magnificent figure of a man and power in the church came up, and he looked at my name, Antala, that's a Finnish name, isn't it? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, I know a lot of Finnish people, and he said, we're working towards merger and all that kind of stuff. And then I said, and he said, you're the secretary. And I said, yes. I said, low man on a totem pole, and I got stuck with this job. And he looked me right in the eye, and he said, Pastor Antala, when the church calls you to do a job, do it the best it's ever been done. And I've never forgotten that.
Yeah.
And I've tried to do the best. And therefore, I've been on some administrative national level of the church ever since my ordination.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's interesting. You found that interesting.
Yeah, to look at the interplay. I served on the Board of Social Ministry for 12 years of the LCA, and Dr. Bill Lazarus, Joe Sittler, Arnie Cirilla, T.A. Cantonin, the theologians of the church, that was better than a seminary education. We were discussing the matters of race, fair housing, conscientious objection to the military, the salvation of creation of man,
mm-hmm.
What salvation means, what redemption means. And these guys, I sat at the feet of the Aristotles and the Platos of the church as far as my day was concerned.
The only one I know of, I know at all, is Joe Sittler.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
He's remarkable.
His whole thesis was that the whole creation groaneth and traveleth, and salvation is the salvation of the whole of the creation.
Mm-hmm.
And he meant nature as well, you know, and he's a great conservationist, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Sittler, who is a great theologian, he's the bishop of the Metropolitan Synod of New York, of our new church.
Oh, yeah.
And he said that, well, surely Christ didn't come to redeem the trees, you know. But the fact is that everybody's come around to understanding that the whole of creation groaneth and traveleth in pain.
Mm-hmm.
And that we have to look at man's salvation to become the saviors of our physical universe so that we can live in it. So that's been
quite an experience.
Yeah,
I would guess that it would be legitimate for you to take considerable satisfaction that you managed to remain as pastor of a growing congregation for 18 years. That's a long stretch, isn't it?
Yeah. At the credit to the Swedish church, they have always treated their pastors well. I don't know every Swedish church. But look at Bethesda. It's had long livers in terms of the pastorate.
Mm-hmm.
That church has had 10, I'm the 10th pastor, they're going for the 11th, but they have returned 13 sons to the ministry. And there are two now, yet in the stage of preparation, one of them, a woman,
mm-hmm.
who will be ordained in another year, I guess. And that church, it has treated its pastors well. They don't know what a vacancy is out there. You know, Olson was here for 25 years, and then and Berg was here. But after Berg's death, they had a six-month vacancy. And that's the last time they had a vacancy, back in 1940 or whatever it was, 43. And then since that time, there has never been a vacancy. When Olson left, he had his associate, Juliet, who stayed here after he left, so they knew no vacancy, but then he left the 1st of November and I arrived on the 16th of November. So they have not known a vacancy for 40 years in this church.
That's real continuity.
But now they're having a vacancy.
Mm-hmm. Hardly know how to deal with it.
They don't know how to deal with it. It's tough for them. But that's there are they have a respect for their pastors. They trust their pastors. They're comfortable with their pastors. And that's a Swedish church.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Although I didn't find any trouble in the German church, the first one I served, in the Finnish church. I enjoyed them all. But and they respect you. They respect you. They don't... nobody called me Phil. I don't mind if they did.
Yeah.
You know, very few did.
But it's Pastor Anthony.
Always.
Yeah.
Even,
yeah.
Still.
Mm-hmm.
Even still.
Even mm-hmm.
still. And they're a churchly church. They like to be led. And but if they disagree with you, they'll vote you down.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll support you. They'll support you. They're a good congregation. Now, I guess that's the satisfaction of knowing that, you know, that there has been fulfillment, that I haven't had to fight and struggle.
Yeah, not a lot of waste motion in dealing
right.
With controversy. And
they have never rejected leadership
mm-hmm.
in anything. They
mm-hmm.
have always done it. They're responsible to the national church. They could have done a lot of things. And I'm going with all of these congregations now. But the benevolence factor has been a high idea, a high goal that they have sought to meet always. I have only the highest there. What disappointing? What are things that... I don't know. My kids, you know, they got a good education up here. They're stabilized. Well, my son is an accountant at the seminary, but he's not. None of them are preachers' kids in the term that oftentimes you cast them an image of.
Yes.
They're just plain good, solid citizens
sure.
who are church aware.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't say. There are always ups and downs, but that goes with the turf. But I don't. I have never ever had the inkling that I should do something else.
Mm-hmm.
I've enjoyed the church.
A lot of satisfaction.
Now, sociological considerations and things that happen in the church, I was thinking about that the other day. I have never known, my first church had around about 500 members. I never knew a divorce. I never knew any of the kinds of things that seemed to be just polluting life.
Sexual
there.
Revolution
That's
had
right.
not,
that
had not arrived.
It was not in the Finnish parish. But here again, the Finnish language does not have a masculine or feminine pronoun. You don't know if a cow is a male cow or a female cow, except if it's called a cow or a bull.
Yeah.
Same about a dog. You don't know. You don't know a person by name, their sex. There is no masculine feminine pronoun in Finnish.
Hmm.
And in a way, that's reflective of the fact that husband and wife, my parents were a team.
Yeah.
They were a team. There wasn't this feminist thing. And there hasn't been
that
in the
need
church.
To be.
In the church, the women have always been on a church council.
Mm-hmm.
And here at Bethesda, when I came to Bethesda, there was no women on a church council. And without any forced kind of effort, it's 50% now.
Sure.
But it's happened on its own.
Mm-hmm.
It was not decreed that there would be a quota. It happened on its own. And I think that goes back to the whole immigrant kind of concept and the Swedish church's view here in this country,
mm-hmm.
that women were a vital part of the life of the church. And I don't think Bethesda would be adverse to... I want to follow through on that marriage and divorce thing. In the Finnish church, there was no... In my last parish, 2,000 members of Olivet Lutheran Church in Sylvania, Ohio, I only know of one divorce. And I had a lot of marriages there.
Sure.
One divorce, and you could almost predict it. They were getting married to protect the baby that was going to be born, and as soon
mm-hmm.
as the baby was born, the thing was over.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You knew it was happening.
No,
you knew
true
it was
marriage.
Happening. Now, the situation today is different. And I've had some of my confirmation, one of my confirmation classes only had 7 pupils, and 5 of them were from broken homes.
Yeah.
2 of them were from, and that's, divorce is a part of life now. And I never knew anything of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's since 1969 coming here, and perhaps a little bit at the end of my ministry in Ohio, that the whole thing was the traditional things were breaking at the seams. And I'm not sitting in judgment over those. I think sometimes the state, I was on the commission of the church who wrote a statement on sex, marriage, and family. And there is a phrase in there that sometimes it is more Christian to be divorced than it is to live together.
Mm-hmm.
It's that clear in that statement.
Sure. Yeah.
So,
so that's a change, however. There's no question as far as the social structure itself is concerned.
But I don't see anything that I regret losing in terms of the church. Perhaps a kind of piety, but I think that piety is there, but it's taken, perhaps you could call it responsibility more than piety. Mm-hmm. There is a responsibility, sense of responsibility,
mm-hmm.
and an awareness of what the faith means. I've not known any congregation splitting battles.
Mm-hmm.
Never.
You've been very fortunate. It says something about your leadership, probably says something about the particular church also. I'm talking really broadly the church, because that's less and less true of the Lutherans, I think, than many other denominations.
This community is exceptional. People don't know how marvelous a community they have here. Maybe they do, but, you know, with the three, well, here in this community, Concordia, Morehead State, and the technical school, and then university across the way, and all of the medical facilities, and the type, caliber of the intellectual milieu of this. I don't know how many. This is true of every church. Trinity must have umpteen PhDs and professors, and the other, our Saviors and Christ the King and Good Shepherd, they must all. We too.
Sure.
We too. Of people of high educational attainment.
And who have chosen to identify with the congregation.
Exactly. And leaders of the congregation. Yeah. Leaders of the congregation.
Yeah. No, it's exceptional in that way.
There is a...
Well, I'm going to give you one last shot.
What's that?
In other words, I'm not going to ask you any more questions, but do you have any last thing?
Last right.
That you...
last things.
I think we've covered quite well.
I really don't know. What about tomorrow? Söderblom, the old Swedish archbishop, was a pioneer in ecumenicity. That, you know, somebody once said, either the church is going to hang together or hang separately. And I think that maybe that sunk in.
Mm-hmm.
And the ecumenical movement, the word is threadbare, but the need and the thrust is becoming rather obvious, that the prayer of Christ, that the church might be one, in the 17th chapter of St. John's Gospel, that the church may be one, even as you and I, Father, are one. I think that's going to be. I don't think it's going to be. It's going to be. It's got to be. That the only way that the church can ever fulfill its mission. It's got to be.
Mm-hmm.
And there will always be the Ananiases that are going to fleece the sheep rather than feed them. There will always be that. And yet, the whatever else may be said, you know, the revolution going on in the whole of the Roman Catholic world that has groaning and traveling, more than what the Protestant churches are. We all are going through those birth pains. But it will be. It will be. And it will not be because anybody is the church and somebody else is not. It's because the church is many faceted. what was that? They used to sing a song. There, I think it was the movie by that name. Love is a many splendored thing. Sure. You know, there, how do you define love? It can be a subject, it can be a predicate, it can be a verb, it can be a noun, it can be whatever. You know, love.
True.
And it's a many splendored thing, and I think the church is a many splendored thing. And because it is nevertheless splendored, it will still find itself more and more becoming the one church that Christ prays for. It is, in fact. It is, in fact. I have brothers and sisters that are Presbyterians and nothing, virtual atheists, differing kinds of congregational life that they participate in, or none. And yet when we're together, we're a family.
Mm-hmm.
We're family. None of that means anything, whatever the denominational tag is.
Yeah, because you have a unifying thing.
That's right. But
you can say the same about the church, that there are various ways, but nevertheless there is a unifying. Yeah.
Without Christ, there is no unifying factor, and it is the Christian church that unifies. And I would see it going beyond that. Jesus once said, I have sheep that are not of this fold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and beyond that, into these other insights of the Eastern religions, I think that there's God knows when and how, but they all have searched to find something in which there's a commonality that lifts us above ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And creates us to be more than what we would otherwise be, and that's across the line, and that will come. But just as my family has many facets, my own particular family also is my particular concern.
Sure.
You know, right now, I'm all these cousins and relatives, they're all a part of my family, but I happen to be focusing in on this part of that family.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so, similarly with the congregation, you're the family that is the church, and yet you have that single congregation that is most dear to you.
And the new church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church, has fundamental to its purpose that the church might be one. The whole mm-hmm. ecumenical thrust, it cannot forsake that. It's in its constitution. It must not forsake that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they talked about this great upheaval of congregations leaving. I think it totals 30 out of about, 400,000 or 500,000 congregations or whatever.
Right.
Whatever it is. But, you know, the disciples couldn't all stick together either.
No.
And Paul and Peter had their problems.
A lot better reason to do it. More direct. Well, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, William.
I think we got a tape that will definitely be worth people listening to.